when I go in and give a lot of my talks on defending control system environments, and I talk about the biggest problems I see out there, a lot of people come up to me afterwards going, Eric, it was a great talk, but it was sort of a lot of basic fundamental stuff that we've known about for the last 10 years. You really didn't give us anything new, revolutionary that we haven't heard before. And I look at them and say, question, are you doing all those things in your environment? And they're like, well, no. I said, then that's why I keep talking about it, right? Security isn't hard, but you can't secure your environment if you don't know what assets you have. You don't know how they're configured. You don't know how they're connected, and you don't control and manage change in your environment. So if you really want to boil down today in terms of securing network devices, it really comes down to, do you have a list of assets? Do you know how they're connected together? Are you managing the configuration of those assets? And are you controlling change within your environment? If you can get those four things down, you can win. But I'll tell you, if you're not doing those four things, you can buy all the latest gear. You can buy all the latest technology. You can hire all the consultants that you want, and you're still not going to make a lot of forward progress, because all that stuff's not going to help you if you don't have the foundational basic components in place. So once again, as we go through today, just keep in mind, do you have asset management? Do you have configuration control? Do you have data flow diagrams? And do you have change control in your organization? And if you don't have those four items, you might want to focus energy and effort on that, because all the other stuff of buying gear isn't going to help you if you don't have that foundational network security components in place. Then once we talk about the physical, accurate, up-to-date network diagram, the next thing is, great, we know how the data flows. We know how the binary information flows back and forth. What is the meaning of the information? And the way we apply meaning to that information is the two general logical topologies we have out there is shared segment, known as Ethernet. This is where everyone shares the same bandwidth and anyone can talk whenever they want as long as the bandwidth is free. I often call Ethernet conference room discussion. If your boss pulls you and 10 people into a conference room and says, let's talk about X, everyone has an equal chance of talking. But in a conference room, you have to wait for silence, make sure no one else is talking, and then you can talk. That's shared segment. That's Ethernet. The other method is time slicing. Another option could be where your boss says, listen, I need information from every one of you. So I'm going to walk around to each cube and I'm going to give each of you 2 minutes to tell me your thoughts on this new project. And I'm on a tight deadline, so you're going to be limited to 2 minutes. And literally your boss goes to each person and you have 2 minutes. That's time slicing. Everyone is given a guaranteed segment to communicate. Because what's the problem with the conference room environment? If you have a chatty workstation, which would be me, and I'm not shutting up, right, you might not get a chance to speak and you might not get a chance to communicate. So the benefit of the time slicing or token ring is everyone gets a dedicated period in order to communicate. So let's take a look at each of these. Ethernet is what we do in a conference room, and we call what we do in a conference room, or Ethernet, carrier sense multiple access. Essentially, multiple systems have access to the same communication media. Carrier sense says you must listen before you speak and make sure no one else is speaking. So in essence, the way Ethernet or conference rooms work is, if you have something to say, you listen. If somebody is speaking, you wait. If there's silence, then you start communicating. So anyone can communicate whenever they want, as long as no one else is communicating. Now, carrier sense multiple access is nice because most communication is unpredictable. You can't tell me in a control system exactly when any given device is going to communicate at any given time. So the fact that it's just open and available whenever any device needs to communicate is very scalable. What's the two challenges, though, with Ethernet? First, what's the problem with pure CSMA? What if we're sitting here and I hear silence and Mike hears silence and we both start communicating at the exact same time? What occurs? A collision. So what's one of the things we need to do is collision detection. The way we do collision detection is we hear silence and we start speaking. And as I'm speaking, I listen and see if I hear anything else. If what I hear is what I'm saying, then I know it's only me and I keep talking. If I hear things other than what I'm saying, I know that a collision occurred and I would stop communicating at that point. Ethernet does the same thing. You listen and wait for silence. And when you hear silence, you start communicating and then you listen to what you're hearing back. If what you're hearing back is what you're communicating, you keep going. If what you're hearing back is different than what you're communicating, then that means a collision occurred and then you would go in and stop communicating, wait for silence, and then start over again. So we solve the collision problem with collision detection. Second problem with Ethernet. In the early days of Ethernet, when we had very low bandwidth networks, we maybe only had a 10 megabyte backbone, what could occur? If you had one computer that was a very chatty workstation and using up the bandwidth a lot, and you had another sensor that needed to get information in, and they couldn't because the other one was using up all the bandwidth, you could have delays and not be able to get the information you needed from all the sensors in a timely manner. So when we had low bandwidth connections, what did we create as an alternative? Time slicing or token ring communication. With token ring communication, each device gets a dedicated period of time in order to communicate. And the way we do that is we have a virtual token. So if I have the token and it's empty, I can put my data in and send it around the network. Then I would grab the token, take my data out, pass it to the next person. They would put their data in, pass it around the network, remove their data, pass it to the next person. So in token ring, every person gets a dedicated slice of time to communicate. So now you can guarantee that you can get your information back in a timely manner. Now, token ring is typically not used that much today for two reasons. One, what is token ring assuming? That every device needs to communicate on a regular basis. That's not typically true. So what will happen is token ring is very inefficient because you're given every system an equal chance, but many of those systems have nothing to say. So it's just wasted opportunity or bandwidth. Imagine if we did token ring in here. I'm a very chatty workstation and most of you are in receive mode. But if I could only talk for a minute, and then I had to go around the room and give every one of you a minute to speak. And then I was able to speak for a minute. Again, each one of you a minute. We would be here till midnight. We would never get through. It would be an inefficient use of the bandwidth. Second issue. Bandwidth on networks have increased. Now with Ethernet, even in control systems, it's not uncommon to have gigabyte backbones to communicate on that LAN, which means even if you have a very chatty workstation, if they're chatting at this amount of bandwidth and you have that much, you're still never ever going to be able to saturate that bandwidth and every system will still be able to get its information in a pretty timely manner. So because of the inefficiencies of token ring and the increases in bandwidth on our backbone, we're still seeing a lot of Ethernet being used today, and that issue of timely updates and information is not a problem because of the large amount of bandwidth that's available for the communication. So we cover token ring really more for legacy purposes because most of the environments are going to be Ethernet. We still run across token ring periodically in some older environments, but more and more and more, it's pretty much going to be Ethernet for those reasons that I just mentioned. One of the other protocols that's out there is ATM. ATM is asynchronous transfer mode. And the idea of ATM is when you send information over a network, you have something called the frame size. A frame is the box that you use to send your data. So think of a frame as a virtual box. If I wanted to physically send you information, I would need to go in and put that information in a box and send it to you. Now, I could go in and I could use small boxes, I can use medium boxes, and I can use large boxes to send the information. Each one has benefits associated with it. The benefit of using a big box is I can send you a lot of information with only filling out one address. So there's a very low header to data ratio, which makes it easier for me. But what's the problem with a large box? If I'm only sending you a small item, there's a lot of wasted space and I'm paying for a lot of space that I'm not needed. On the other hand, a small box, the benefit is if I'm sending you a small amount of information, there's very little wasted bandwidth and it's very efficient. What's the problem though with a small box? What if I'm sending you a large amount of data? I have to put each amount in a bunch of boxes and I have to fill out 20 labels now. So the header to data ratio is very, very inefficient. So the way it works is Ethernet is a medium-sized box. Ethernet uses a 1500 byte frame, which is about a medium-sized box. Gig Ether uses a large box, typically 10,012 bytes, sometimes called jumbo frames. And ATM uses really small boxes, which are only 48 bytes with a 5-byte header. So depending on the amount of information and type of data that you're communicating, you could go in, and if you have small amounts of information on a high-speed network, then ATM works really good because it's a small box, minimal wasted space, on and off the network real quickly. The drawback with ATM, really small boxes, is if I need to send you 500 megs of information, then that's every 48 bytes need 5 bytes of header, and the data-to-header ratio is very, very inefficient to work. However, in some environments where you're sending sensor information that's very small amount but high frequency, that's where ATM could work out very nicely, because if you're sending very small amounts of data, high frequency with Ethernet, you have 1,500 bytes to only send 20 bytes of data, and you have a lot of wasted space in doing that. So in some environments where we're doing a lot of small sensory information coming back and forth, ATM can work very nicely because of the small efficient size and minimal wasted space in the communication. Then when we talk about our WAN technologies, traditionally we would use wired WAN technologies. So if you go back 15, 20 years ago, a lot of the WAN connectivity was typically going to be wired just because a lot of the wireless technology wasn't fully developed and very, very, very expensive. So you would go in and run the wires to the remote sites. You can do dedicated lines. Dedicated lines are great because they're well dedicated. So you know it's only for your communication and tends to be fairly secure. What's the problem with dedicated lines? They're very expensive because you're paying for the bandwidth, whether you're using it or not, and the farther the distance, the more expensive it is. So if you have a remote site that's only sending information 15, 20 times a day, and the rest of the time it's just idle, you're paying for that bandwidth whether it's used or not. So dedicated lines can be very, very expensive. So we then switched to a shared segment, which was frame relay, where now your WAN providers would set up a private network across a region, And now, if you wanted to communicate, you don't have to go point to point. You just connect to that private network, and then it sets up a virtual private circuit within that network. The early stages of that technology was frame relay, but frame relay was very low bandwidth, so it's being replaced with multi-protocol label switching as the other efficient way of being able to go in and get more efficient wide area network communication. And there are international MPLS networks available. You also have a variety of traditionally consumer grade high speed services. Depending on the countries you're in, those can range from ISDN to DSL, cable modems, high speed fiber networks. And they were traditionally meant for residential or consumer grade high speed service. What's happening? These consumer grade WAN connections are so prevalent, so high bandwidth and so cheap that in a lot of cases you have clients saying, well, wait a second. Why are we paying for a dedicated line that's this much money and that much bandwidth when I can go in and use one of the consumer grade services that's that much money and that much bandwidth? So you're starting to see some of this technology that was originally built for residential consumer purposes now used in the commercial arena just because of the lower cost, high bandwidth. Then when we look at our network devices, if we're going in and setting up a star topology, which is by far the most common physical topology. If I'm going into a building and I want to wire up the building, I'm typically going to run a wire to each office for communication, and then we're going to have a wiring closet in which we have all the wires connected together there. So imagine that this was an office building and every one of you were in a separate office in that building. If I wanted to set up the physical topology, the most common way of doing that is I would run a single wire to each one of your offices that you would connect together. Now, if I did that, I would now have 26 wires that I have to connect together. How do I connect them so you can communicate back and forth? The basic way of doing that is with a hub. A hub is a pretty dumb device, and the way it works with a hub is every system receives the data from every other system. So if we have a situation where we have a hub, and we have computer A, B, C, D, and E all plugged in. If computer A wanted to communicate with computer C, how does it work in a hub? That information is sent from A, and the hub sends it to every single computer. So every single computer receives the data. Now, what are the computers supposed to do? They're supposed to, every network interface card that you use to connect to a network has a unique 6-byte address called the MAC address. So every NIC has a unique MAC. So every frame that is sent out has a destination MAC. So what every computer is supposed to do is when they receive the frame that was forwarded by the hub, they're supposed to look at the destination MAC, look at their MAC and say, do they match? If they match, process it. If they don't match, drop it. So now computer B is going to receive the frame, look at the destination MAC, look at its MAC, say it doesn't match, drop it. Computer C is going to look at the destination MAC, look at its MAC, they match, so it processes it. Computer D is going to look at the destination MAC, its MAC, say they don't match and drop it. Now, what if Evil Eric is plugged into the network? What can Evil Eric do? Evil Eric can plug a sniffer into his system. And what a sniffer does is it goes in and puts the NIC in promiscuous mode. Promiscuous mode is where you tell your NIC, don't do the MAC check. Any frame that you receive, just give to me. Don't even check the address and just give me all that data. So in this case, if E has a sniffer installed and we're plugged into a hub, what will E be able to see? everything, all the information. And remember, in control system environments, we use a lot of Telnet and FTP. What's the problem with Telnet and FTP? Everything, including user ID and passwords, are sent plain text. So if you're using a hub environment and you're using those non-secure protocols, somebody can sniff and intercept and get all of the passwords, user IDs, and details going over the network. So what's the better alternative is to go in and use a switch. The way a switch works is it takes the logic that was done at the computer level and now does it at a switch level. So now what happens is when you plug into a switch, the switch is going to probe every device and store the MAC addresses for each computer in the switch. Now watch what happens. Now when computer A wants to communicate with computer C, what's going to occur? The frame is going to be sent to the switch. The switch is going to look at the MAC address and say, oh, that MAC address is plugged in here. Send it to C. Now only C is receiving the data. So now even if Evil Eric has a sniffer, Evil Eric's not receiving the frame and therefore won't be able to sniff it off the network. So switches are considered a lot more secure because it makes it harder for somebody to sniff and analyze and get traffic they shouldn't. So in wired networks, we're actually utilizing switches to make sniffers much more difficult. Question, where do we still use hubs today? Where are hubs still very prevalent in our organization? Wireless. Wireless is a hub. When you're going in and I'm sending my data to a wireless access point, anyone else in that vicinity can see that traffic and information. So remember, it's great that we're putting switches on our wired networks, but we said one of the trends in control systems is more and more wireless, and wireless is hub-based communication. So the more wireless you're putting there, the more hub communication, which means if you're doing Telnet and FTP, over wireless, somebody can be able to intercept and gather and capture all that information. So hubs and switches are both still utilized in today's communication. Then another technology is a bridge. If we're using Ethernet, and let's say this classroom's on an Ethernet segment, you would all be on what we call the same collision domain. So what would happen is, what if I'm a real chatty workstation and Graham's a real chatty workstation? And every time Graham and I both try to communicate, collision, collision, collision. If more than half of the communication on your Ethernet backbone are collisions, that's what we call a fully saturated domain. So what would we do in that case? If I'm in the front of the room and Graham's in the back, I would go in and I would break us up into two separate collision domains. So now Eric's on one collision domain, Graham is on another, and I would use a bridge to break up that Ethernet domain into two separate collision domains. So bridges were ways that we would go in and take a large Ethernet and break it up into smaller pieces to minimize collisions between chatty workstations. Now, if you're in a wired network with a switch, what is a switch? Isn't it a specialized bridge? Doesn't a switch put each system on its own separate collision domain? It does. So in a switched environment, bridges are obsolete. So in wired networks where we're using switches, we don't need bridges anymore because the switch performs the bridging at an individual system level. However, where do we still need bridges? Where hubs are located, and where do we use hubs wireless? So you're still going to have wireless bridges and wireless hubs within your environment, even though hub bridges are obsolete in wired networks because switches are utilized in those environments. Then a router is a device that connects two or more networks together and moves packets back and forth between those networks. It might seem like an oversimplification, but the internet is really just a bunch of routers. That's really what the internet is. When you communicate over the internet, you just have a bunch of routers that move your packets one step closer to the destination. And that ultimately allows communication back and forth between different networks to occur. So at this point, let's take our morning break, and then we'll come back and do a little more discussion of switches. So let's take 15 minutes, and we'll come back at 10:55, and then we'll continue our discussions. And like I said, either right before or right after lunch, depending on how it goes, we'll have a lab to break up the day, and then we'll wrap up the day with crypto. Enjoy your break. All right, so before break, we were talking about hubs and switches. And one big difference was the fact that a hub, you can sniff all traffic and see everything going off the network. With a switch, you can't. There's another big difference. If I went in and I plugged all of you into a hub, everyone would be on the same network whether you liked it or not. Everyone would be able to see everyone's traffic and be able to be on the same subnet. However, if I go in and plug you into a switch, we could now set up what we call VLANs. So I literally can go in and I could say you three or you five are in one VLAN, you three are in another VLAN, you four are in another VLAN. So literally, I could put you anywhere in the network. You can plug in anywhere you want, and then I can go into the switch itself and isolate out different systems to put them on different virtual networks to isolate, reduce, and control that visibility. So this is sort of a visual example where this could be your supervisor control network. These can be all the different devices that just are randomly plugged in based on physical location. And then I can logically break them down into different networks and communication paths and even potentially do filtering, firewalling between those different VLANs to start minimizing, reducing exposure. Now, important, VLANs are good to further subdivide a trust level, but we should never be having VLANs cross different trust levels. So if we go in and we look at what we've done earlier, where we have the internet, you have your business, DMZ, you have your business network, you have your internal DMZ, and you have your supervisory network. I am fine with you doing VLANs here, VLANs here, VLANs here, VLANs here. So I'm okay with you having a switch with VLANs, having another switch with VLANs, having another switch with VLANs, and having another switch with VLANs. That's perfectly okay. What I'm not okay with is having one switch where you have VLANs across each segment. This is not acceptable because the problem is we want to have physical separation, and VLANs are fine for further limiting visibility within a trust level, but we never want to go in and have VLANs cross trust levels, because if somebody misconfigures, doesn't set up, or doesn't register it correctly, then you can have a situation where somebody could bypass or get around those controls. There is something called VLAN hopping, where if we're not careful, somebody could go in and be able to jump to different VLANs on the system. And we have seen cases where during attacks, we have been able to go from here to here, bypassing all of the security controls and mechanisms that are in place on that system. So when we're talking about VLANs, it's used for further subdividing a trust level, but never ever cross trust levels with VLANs. That would be a really, really bad thing. The two other question. Yes. So it's the same thing whether we're talking about the VLANs, the trunking, or others. You want to have separate physical switches between each of those different areas. Right. So are you saying that you want to trunk here? Yeah. If you're trunking here and controlling where you're only going zone to zone, that's okay. What you never can do is trunk cross. So if you want to trunk, if you want to go in and do trunking at this level, that's okay. But you can't ever trunk around those different levels there. So we want to limit or control that. So we're going in, and when we talk about switches, one of the nice things about it is we can further subdivide them into the VLANs. But like I said, VLANs are good for better restricting within a trust level, but you never ever want VLANs to cross trust levels. You always want separate physical switches in each of those areas and then further create VLANs. Also, a VLAN by itself doesn't perform isolation. It just puts it on a separate subnet. So technically, if we're going in and we're VLANing our switch, we would need a router capability either connected or embedded within that switch to perform the routing. And by default, just because I go in and I have you on one VLAN and you on another, you can still route traffic back and forth. So just setting up the VLANs doesn't stop access. You would then need to go in and put in an ACL, an access control list, or a firewall blade in that switch. So what we're seeing in these environments is you would get a high-end switch that has a router blade, a firewall blade, and then you could go in and filter and route and limit traffic between it. So I just want to make sure you recognize that a VLAN by itself is just putting systems on separate subnets. A VLAN doesn't control flow of traffic. You would have to add filtering in at the VLAN level to accomplish that task. Then we have two other challenges. One is, hopefully, in a control system environment, we have pretty good physical security. I'm hoping that somebody is not going to be able to easily physically walk in to your facility and start plugging into networks. However, it could happen. You could have visitors and you could have other folks. So we want to control who can connect to our network. Problem one, many organizations went a little crazy on wiring. If you walk around your facility, there's RJ45 jacks everywhere. There's network jacks all over the network in different places. We've gone to some of our utility clients, and they literally in the visitor center will have an RJ45 jack that while you're waiting for them to check your background or call for your escort, I've had times where the guard's not really paying attention, authorized, and we plug in to the network jack and we're just sitting there having full access. I've seen network jacks outside of buildings, network jacks in conference rooms and other areas. So what's the first rule? The first rule is if there's not a computer plugged in to that jack, disable it in the switch. Any unused ports should be disabled at a switch level to make sure that somebody can't just walk up and plug a device into a network. Step one. Step two, even if there's a computer plugged into a network jack, what's the challenge? Somebody could go disconnect that computer and plug in their own malicious computer. So in order to stop somebody from disconnecting authorized access, what do we do at the second level? We go in and implement something called port security. Port security is where you lock a specific MAC to a specific port location. So port security is what we call one-to-one. We're now saying this port in the switch can only have this MAC address plugged into it. So now by doing port security, which is one-to-one, now if somebody disconnects that cable and plugs in a different computer, it won't work because it's a different MAC address. Port security is great for one-to-one. in an office environment where you have a single computer plugged into a single jack that works fine. What's the problem in control system environments, especially when you get down to the supervisory level? You're having people walking around. You're having field technicians plug into different systems. You're having a lot of different computers plugging into a lot of different ports. What's the problem with port security? It's one-to-one. What do I need? Many-to-many. I need to go in and be able to say any of these legitimate systems based on the MAC address can plug into any of these ports. I need to do many-to-many port security. The way we do that is with 802.1x. 802.1x is where you now go in and you have a list of authorized systems, and any of those computers can plug in to any of the ports on the switch, and anyone else would be denied access. So now you would have an authorized list of all your assets, all your technician devices, and then any of them can plug into any port, but no one else would be able to plug into your system. Now, 802.1x network level authentication is great, but what's the problem? It's assuming that every authorized device is secure and not compromised. What if we have a technician device that is an authorized corporate asset, but they're out at a remote location, they plug into a system they shouldn't, and they get infected with malware? Now when they come back in to your supervisory network, they're going to plug in. What is 802.1x going to say? Valid MAC allow in, and now you're going to have an infected system on your network. So while 802.1x is good to determine what devices can or cannot connect, it doesn't verify or validate the security of the device. That's why we layer on top of 802.1x network access control. Network access control is dynamic VLAN allocation. So now what we're doing is we're going in, and when you connect to a switch, the first thing that happens is 802.1x. So 802.1x is going to check your MAC, see if you're on the authorized list. If you are, then NAC jumps in and NAC scans your computer. Now with NAC, you can do both clientless and client NAC. In essence, you're checking the security parameters of the system, and based on the security parameters, you are determining what VLAN to place that device on. While yes, there is client-based NAC, most implementations use clientless. Why? Two reasons. Reason one, if I have to go in and have a client for every piece of computer equipment that's plugging into my network, in control system environments, that's going to be very limiting, because right now, today, most of the NAC agents are just for your traditional Windows and Linux. With all your specialized devices out there, that wouldn't work. Second issue with client-based NAC. If I'm concerned that a computer might be compromised and I'm asking the compromised computer whether you're compromised, what is a good compromised computer going to say? Well, I'm not compromised. So if the software is on the system that the adversary owns, they could go in and take over the agent and provide back false information. So we typically like clientless NAC, which is where we scan the computer. I'm going to scan the computer, and you can configure it. But typically with NAC, we're going to check for several things. Do you have the corporate security build on your system? Are you fully patched? Are you running endpoint security? And are there any indicators of compromise on your box? If everything checks out correctly, then we put you on the trusted VLAN. If things don't come out correctly and you're missing patches or other issues, we then put you on a less trusted VLAN. So now what we can do is if you look at the supervisory network and we're using network access control, we would actually break this into three separate VLANs. I would have the trusted VLAN, I would have the patch VLAN, and I would have the isolated or quarantined VLAN. Now, when a device plugs into this switch, It's going to go in and check the MAC address for 802.1x and make sure it's authorized. Once it's authorized, NAC is going to scan the device. And if it's fully patched, corporate build, locked down, we're going to put it on the trusted VLAN. If it's missing patches, we'll put it on a patch VLAN where it can download patches. And if it has indications of a compromise, we put it on a quarantine VLAN. So now with network access control, we're adding an additional level of protection where we now can go in and dynamically determine what VLAN to put the device on based on the security, the controls, and the overall risk. This is something that's very, very helpful in especially control system environments because it gives you an automated way to reduce risk. Let me ask you another question. If you're talking a control system environment, critical infrastructure, high loss of life potential, if there's a device that's plugging in and you're 50 or 60% sure that it might have malware on it, which is better for you? Isolating and checking it or letting it connect and causing harm? Typically, because it's an individual device that's mobile, it's better off to play it safe there. Now, what's interesting with NAC is you can only do it for certain things. So you can do it for some devices, not others. You could also go in and set up these networks so you always have access. You're just limiting visibility in different areas. So for example, with field devices, you might never ever want to block a field device from not being accessible. But you might want to go in and have a field device limit the information it can send if you believe it might be compromised, but you can still send updates to it. So you really have a lot of creativity in control systems to allow the functionality, but minimize or reduce the exposure by setting up limited access VLANs. So there's some access, but not all the access that's required. So if we look at the use of VLANs and NAC in control systems. We covered most of this, which is once again, when I said the VLAN should never mix business control, that's when I said never cross trust levels. You always want to have separate physical switches. And then if you want to further subdivide VLANs within a trust level, that's okay, but never cross trust levels with that. This is an area where control systems are actually a little ahead of corporate environments. Most corporate environments, because of the complexity and the manageability, aren't using NAC a lot today. It's a good solid solution, but in a large, large environment, it's too hard to manage. Well, in control systems, if you have very specialized areas like a control center or a certain operational center, and you want to be very selective on which devices can plug in, then you can go in and use network access control as a great way for doing that. Here's another nice little way of using NAC. You can use NAC to minimize the impact of what I call stupid human user tricks. What's one of the big problems we've talked about? USB drives. Yes, you can go in and you can restrict USB drives from being plugged into a system, but there might be business need required for it. What we can do with NAC is you can actually have a list of authorized USB devices. So now if a user plugs in an unauthorized USB device, NAC can actually isolate that device and not allow it to be on your network. So now you're in a situation where you have to allow some USB, but not all USB, so you can't block it, but you can have NAC go in, and if they're unauthorized, isolate or quarantine that device and set off an alert. So you can even have it minimize some of the human-based attacks with USB or other devices that might be plugged in to that area. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at some of the devices, we've looked at how VLANs and NAC can help us within our environment. Now let's go in and start looking at the protocol and language that computers speak so we can start understanding and looking for those anomalies. Before we jump in to some of the routing lower layer protocols, are there any questions with what we just covered, went over? Excellent. So with that, let's go ahead and start looking at communication over a network and the different layers that are utilized by our devices. A protocol is nothing more than rules of communication. So anytime you're going to communicate or interact with another entity, you're going to have a protocol. The English language is a protocol. If you participate in sports, the rule of the sports is a protocol. So anytime you're engaging in any interaction, whether it's communication or exchange of any other information, you're going to be using a protocol in order to do that. So it shouldn't surprise you that if humans use a protocol called the English language to communicate, that computers would have a protocol called a network protocol in order to communicate. Now, we're also going to mirror the English language. The English language is fairly complex. So what do? We break it into pieces. When you learned about the English language, the teacher just didn't go in and throw a bunch of stuff at you. What did they do? We broke a sentence down into pieces, a noun and a verb, a subject and an object. And then we added in adjectives and adverbs and pronouns. Essentially, when we learned about the English language, we took a sentence and broke it down into each individual piece. And then literally we put the pieces together to form a meaningful sentence. So if we're going to take the English language protocol and break it into individual pieces, it shouldn't surprise you that we're going to take a network protocol and, in order to make it more manageable, break it down into pieces called a protocol stack. It turns out there are two protocol stacks that we use in network communication. We have the 7-layer OSI protocol stack and the 4-layer TCP/IP protocol stack. Why do we have two stacks? Because the OSI stack is always used whenever we're discussing and explaining network connectivity, and the TCP/IP protocol stack is always used in implementation. So if we are discussing or talking about functionality at a network level in control systems, we're always going to use the 7 layers of OSI. And if we're implementing the functionality on a real live network, we're going to be using TCP/IP. So TCP/IP is used for implementation. OSI is used for discussion and analysis. Now, the one little trick that we have to remember is even when we're discussing TCP/IP, we still use the 7 layers of OSI. So notice, you'll never ever go in and call the TCP/IP model layers 1, 2, 3, and 4. That would confuse yourself and others. We always map it back to the 7 layers of OSI. Remember, OSI is always used in discussing and analyzing network functionality, even when we're discussing and analyzing the TCP/IP implementation. So that's why in TCP/IP, network is called layers 1 and 2, internet is called layer 3, transport is called layer 4, and the application is called 5, 6, and 7. Now, in order to understand this breakdown, let's go in and look at these 7 layers of OSI. Starting at the bottom, the physical layer, that's the physical transmission of the binary data. That's the physical transmission of zeros and ones. In traditional IT environments, the 3 main methods of physical transmission is electrical, which is what Ethernet uses, fiber optic, which is what fiber optic communication uses, and radio frequency. In industrial control systems, we often don't use fiber optic that much because of the fragile nature of certain distances. Internally, you might, but in WAN links, you're not going to see it as widely used as you do in other areas. You mainly see a lot of radio frequency, and we add in microwave and satellite communication into that. So because of the remote nature of some of those devices, you typically get a little more infrared and satellite and cellular that you wouldn't get in a lot of your traditional IT networks. So we're going to be adding in a few more with cellular, infrared, and satellite communication as other physical transmission mechanisms. Then layer 2 is the meaning of the information. So layer 2 is where your logical topology sits. So layer one is the physical receipt of the zeros and ones, and layer two is the logical topology of what does that information mean. Layer three is the routing layer. Layer three is responsible for routing and moving packets back and forth between source and destination. Layer four is responsible for transporting your application data. Layer five is responsible for setting up a virtual session between the two systems to communicate the traffic back and forth. Layer six is responsible for putting the information in a unified format. Let me show you the importance of layer six. We mentioned that computers are binary devices. Computers have zero or one, on or off, yes or no. A single bit can only have two states. Therefore, it's not very useful. So what do? We take 8 bits and we combine them together into a byte of information. So 8 bits equals a byte. So if I go in and I write out a byte of information, 1110001. Question, do we read that from left to right? Or do we read that from right to left? It depends. Some devices are left justified, known as big endian notation, and some devices are right justified, known as little endian notation. Well, here's the problem. If I have a field device that's left justified, and I have a control system that's right justified, and they try reading that, what's going to happen? Corrupt information and data. So layer six, the presentation layer, is going to take this machine-dependent representation and convert it to a machine-independent format. So the presentation layer is often overlooked, but is one of the critical layers because it's going to take machine-dependent data and convert it to machine-independent so different devices from different vendors can all interpret the information in the same manner. Then layer seven, the application layer, is the actual applications that the user is running over the network. That could be the web, email, file transfer, telnet, can all be those different applications. So that's the core seven layers of functionality that we always have. Now, when we go to implement this in practice, watch what happens. When they went to implement this on a live network, it turns out when you create the physical network interface card to connect to the network, that physical network interface card has to have the logical topology built in to that card. So our NIC actually takes care of layers one and two. If you don't believe me, go to a computer store. When you go to a computer store, can you buy a generic NIC? Can you buy a generic NIC for any network? No. You can buy an Ethernet card, you can buy a token ring card, you can buy a wireless card, but the card that you buy has the actual logical topology implemented within the card. This laptop that I'm traveling with actually has three NICs. It has an 802.3 Ethernet NIC, it has an 802.11 wireless NIC, and it has an EVDO cellular NIC, so I can connect to three different type networks. So because the actual logical topology is implemented to the NIC, layers one and two are combined together. Then for routing, we use IP, the Internet Protocol. The Internet Protocol is the foundational protocol of the TCP/IP network because every single piece of information must have an IP header because that's what the routers use to determine the path the packet's going to take. IP doesn't have any built-in error checking, and because error checking is a fundamental part of routing, we created another layer three protocol called ICMP, which is the Internet Control Message Protocol, and that's going to go in and be able to take care of error messaging and troubleshooting for IP. Then at layer four for transporting our data, we have TCP and UDP communication. Why do we have two protocols? TCP is guaranteed delivery. UDP is not guaranteed delivery. So if we need to make sure the information gets there, we use TCP. If we don't care whether the information gets there, we use UDP. Then when we started implementing our actual applications like HTTP, FTP, Telnet, it turns out that those applications actually take care of the session, the presentation, and the application component. So when we actually wrote the applications, it actually took care of 5, 6, and 7 in the OSI protocol stack. So when we discuss network functionality, there are 7 layers, but when we implement it, there's actually 4 components. The NIC that takes care of layers 1 and 2, IP/ICMP that takes care of layer 3, TCP/UDP that takes care of layer 4, and your HTTP, FTP, and Telnet that take care of layers 5, 6, and 7. So while there's 7 layers that we cover in discussion, there's 4 pieces that implement those 7 layers. And remember, we always use the 7 layers of OSI whenever we're talking about functionality. So if we have a routing issue with IP, that's a layer 3 problem. If we have a TCP issue, that's a layer 4 problem. If we have a application issue, that's a layers 5, 6, and 7 problem. So we're always going to use those 7 layers in discussing and analyzing where the problem is with the communication. Now that we implement it, the way that it works is when we want to communicate, we're going to have a client, we're going to have a field device, we're going to have some entity, and it wants to make communication to a server. So what does it do? It starts at the top of the stack. It goes down the stack, out the network. Every hub or switch opens to layer 2. Every router opens to layer 3. And then we get to the destination. The destination passes it back up to the application. The application processes the request, gets the information they wanted. We go back down the stack, out layer 1. Every switch opens to layer 2. Every router opens up to layer 3. We then get back to layer 1 on the receiving computer, goes back up to layer 7 and presents the information to the user of the device or whatever application requested it. So whenever we do communication, we always start at 7, go down the 1, across the network, back up again. Now that's great, but there's one little problem. As we go down the stack, there's something that occurs in called encapsulation, which is where the lower layers hide the details of the higher layer. Let me give an example. Telnet, FTP, and HTTP all use TCP as the layer 4 protocol. So if any one of those applications, whether it's Telnet, whether it's FTP, whether it's HTTP, when they get to layer 4, they're going to be encapsulated by TCP and down the stack. Now here's the problem. Because we have to go down the stack across and back up again, when we get to layer 4 here, how does the transport layer or TCP know which application to send it to? It doesn't. So what has to happen? Layer 4 on the sending computer has to tell layer 4 on the receiving computer what application to send it to. Each of those layers need to virtually talk so it knows where to send it back on the processing side. Problem, those layers can't directly communicate. We have to go down the stack, across and back up again, which means we have to create virtual communication between layer 4 on the sender and layer 4 on the receiver so it knows which application to send it to. How do we do that? The way we do that is with a simple yet elegant solution. As we go down the stack, each layer adds a header of information, and as we go up the stack, each layer removes a header of information. Now, a header is nothing more than data in a fixed location. So it's data that's always in a fixed location and always processed in the same manner. You have all used headers and probably didn't realize it. Well, let me make sure. Is there anyone in here who's never, ever sent a letter via the physical mail system? We all have. Well, guess what? If you've gone in and you've sent a letter, you've dealt with three headers. If we look at a typical envelope, we have three headers. We have the from header. We have the to header. And we have the postage header.